In our exploration and study of the Heart Sutra, we talked last week about this bit, kind of right in the middle, after the initial statement that the aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, are empty. The text goes on to say it's also the case for really all of the formal structures of Dharma practice. So the senses we talked about last week are empty. And so this part of the text has a couple of layers of meaning, right? One is that it's actually teaching us, first of all, the text teaches us the core doctrines. It's, in some basic way, it says, remember the aggregates, remember the senses, remember dependent origination, remember liberation, the Four Noble Truths. This is like the list of lists. So on one level, it functions to remind us of the teachings. On another level, of course, it undercuts those teachings by saying that they're all empty. And in a simple way, that partly means that it's reminding us that teachings, or the Dhamma, is still just concepts. The Four Noble Truths, they're noble, they're important, they're the heart of the Buddha's teachings, they're the definition of right view, they're the way I now see the world, they're the thing that liberates. All true. And they're concepts. They're concepts, they're empty. They don't exist in and of themselves, separate from everything else, they're not permanent. They point to something that's permanent, but they are not themselves permanent. So dukkha is a fact of life that reappears in endless guises everywhere. But the concept of dukkha, the understanding that there is such a thing as dissatisfaction that has a cause, that's a teaching that is present in the world at the moment because the Buddha happened and taught it, and it's been remembered. And at some point, it will be forgotten. And then dukkha as a concept will not be present in the world. There will still be, you might say, dissatisfaction as long as there are conscious beings. But if those beings don't call it dukkha, if they don't have the conception of dukkha, right, it's not dukkha in the way that the Four Noble Truths is talking about dukkha, because dukkha is a concept that liberates. Right? It's an idea that liberates. And so part of what emptiness means is that everything is a concept. And concepts are conditioned. They're conditioned on history. They're conditioned on certain kinds of communities and spaces where those concepts are alive. And so that's another layer that the text points to. Everything, all these categories that we think of as solid and helpful, the categories of the Dhamma, they are, the words are empty, the concepts are empty, the lists are provisional, empty, conditional. So that's a second layer. A next layer to the recognition of emptiness is also to recognize that these concepts that form the teachings, dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, etc., it's not just that they're concepts. Like, they point to something useful, helpful, real in whatever way, but that those experiences themselves are also empty in a very particular way, which is that they are interwoven with, conditioned by, and themselves conditioning you know, this vast web of experience. And so then they nothing can stand alone as an identifiable singular thing. And so the teaching on dependent origination says that because of such and such a condition, such a thing comes to be. So because of sensory contact, feeling comes to be, right? The experience of something being pleasant or unpleasant. And because there is pleasantness or unpleasantness, because pleasantness and unpleasantness is an experience that happens, because of that, craving comes to be. Not automatically, not necessarily, right? Feeling like pleasantness or unpleasantness doesn't cause craving, like in a direct one-to-one sort of way. You can have a pleasant feeling without craving. You can have a pleasant feeling with craving. But you can't have craving without pleasant feeling. Right? So the pleasant feeling conditions the experience of craving. It's a necessary condition, but it's not a direct cause. Right? It's not one-to-one. And so dependent origination describes this web of possibilities, and it describes how experience unfolds. And one of the most important ways to understand it is to walk it backwards. You know, is to say, oh, I'm noticing myself suffering. There's some craving. I really want something, or I'm really clinging to something. You know, I find myself obsessively attached to things being a certain way. Like, you know, I don't know, winning an election next week. You know, not myself winning the election, right? The people that I prefer winning the election, I have that preference. To the extent that that preference, that I think would be good for this country, for the world, to the extent that that preference lodges in my heart as a kind of painful constriction around an idea of how things should be, that pain is dukkha, right? It's being caused by craving. And the teaching in dependent origination is to say, oh, if I want to really understand that craving, one of the things that I can do is I can look backwards in the sequence toward the condition that must be present for craving to arise. And that condition, right, is feeling. Something's pleasant, something's unpleasant, right? I have the experience of, you know, the words and actions of one of our political parties being far more pleasant to me than the other. You know, and just as a caveat, neither of those are absolutes, right? I don't find one of them to be completely satisfying. I find one of them to be almost completely unsatisfying, but I could find some golden, motes of light in there as well. There's a sincerity, at least in part of it. But based on my perception then of these things that are spoken, and that some are to me pleasant and some are to me unpleasant, it's given rise to craving. And so if I want to be free of that craving, I'm going to have to come to terms with feeling. And the main thing that we are invited to do is to understand that feeling doesn't have to lead to craving. It can exist in a way and be felt on its own without added reactivity. So it's entirely possible, the Buddha says, and I think we could all come up with examples of what moments when we've felt this actual wise response to life, where we've felt the pleasant or the unpleasant, and even really had a kind of a preference. Like I could very clearly say, I think this result next Tuesday will be better than this result for lots of reasons. And I could even like pray for it or, you know, really want it. And I could, it's possible to do that without being, you know, thrown off my center, without like staying awake at night worrying, without like obsessively checking the news and, you know, refreshing the polls every 8 hours, you know, how's it going? Like, it's actually possible to care about something very deeply without being subject to the kind of constriction of the heart that's called craving, right? So this is the nature of the conditional relationship. Feeling conditions craving, but doesn't cause it. And so then this is the key link in dependent origination, to be able to feel the world, which is sometimes pleasant and sometimes unpleasant, a lot of times neutral, to feel that without the particular constriction of the heart that we call craving. This is the heart of dependent origination in a very straightforward way. Now the Heart Sutra comes in and says, oh, by the way, that's empty. So it means not only is that concepts, which we could acknowledge, okay, those are concepts, they are contingent on the Buddha's teachings being in the world and various other things, language and, you know, education, any number of, you know, conditions have to be present for those concepts to even make sense to us or be perceivable in the world. But more than that, it says, but not only that, but the things they point to themselves are also empty. So like the craving, right? It's a feeling, it's a kind of tone in the heart, it's a state, you know, it's a state that's a kind of an impulse toward action, right? Craving is the condition for clinging, which is kind of the action step, really holding on, trying to make things be a certain way. That craving, okay, so what is it? You know, it's a state, it's an energy, it's momentary. We can tell that it's caused by, or sorry, conditioned by, you know, these various other factors, the presence of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, but also, you know, it's conditioned by other things, right? What's happening out in the larger world, who I am in relation to it, what my social location is in relation to it, my privilege or trauma or, you know, oppression placement in relation to what's happening. All of these things are conditions that give rise to this craving. Therefore, the craving can't be isolated from its conditions, right? You can't separate it out and say, this is its own thing. It has its kind of solid identity, separate from all these various conditions that have given rise to it. In a way, I think this is meant to be partly really obvious, like, well, yeah, and partly, you know, radical and subtle. Because the thing emptiness means is that you can't separate something out of the web of the whole and say, like, it just exists. My craving is so bad. You know, I have to deal with my craving. I think we fall into this in contemporary psychology a lot, in New Age psychology a lot, where we think like, oh yeah, I'm having a hard time. I should deal with my feelings. You know, and I try to turn inward and attend to them just as a feeling unto themselves. Mindfulness does this sometimes. Shallow mindfulness teachings will just say, just notice the feeling. Okay, there's craving. And it says, be radically present with the feeling, which is a strategy. This is a meditation technique, right? To let go of the past. We did that a little bit in the meditation tonight. But the understanding of conditions also says this feeling doesn't exist on its own. It's actually empty of independent essence. What it is a response to, it's conditioned by, this whole web of forces that have come into play here. And therefore, it can't be plucked out of the web and attended to on its own. You can't just say, I'm going to deal with this craving and not deal with the conditions, right? You can't just say, okay, the election is making me crazy. I'm now just going to relax and let go. You could do that. I don't see it working, all right? Because to try to do that is almost like saying, I'm going to separate my feeling from the world that's causing it, right? And that's very hard to do. Even if you go on retreat, you know, the world, the drama, it follows you. You know, we're going on retreat next Wednesday, or no, the week after, but you know, 2 weeks. But I'm sure, you know, do we have any idea that the election will be like all over and like spit spot cleaned up, all done with, nobody's complaining by the 13th of November? I do not hold that idea. You know, it very much looks like things might be a shit show for a while. And and so we're gonna go on retreat and you know, go into a field, make a ritual boundary, enter into refuge and precepts and noble silence, and then we'll drop into meditation. And if anyone has the fantasy that the outside world of ferment and, you know, election drama or whatever else your drama is, you know, having a baby drama, getting a new job drama, you know, those conditions are there. And, you know, that doesn't mean like, oh, you know, I'm now forced to worry. Like the whole point of practice and of working these steps of dependent origination is a way to say that with practice, I actually don't have to worry about this, right? I've cast my vote. There's some way that like we sent in our ballots, we did our early voting. You know, I still care, but in this tiny little way, I've done that part of my part. You know, I did other things. I sent money in, I did some stuff, you know, various things. But like I did my voting part and now I can feel how there's some way that it's, that aspect of it is out of my hands. And I know this, I know the feeling from other elections where like after election night ends, whatever the process is afterward, I'm like, oh, all of the particular kind of work, the get out the vote work, the sending postcards, the door knocking, the calling your annoying relatives in swing states, you know, like whatever the thing is that you've done or have to do, that part is done. And there's a kind of like, okay, it's out of our hands now, in whatever way, in some particular ways it is. And so understanding conditionality is partly a support for knowing when and how to let go. When is it time to be like, okay, you know, we did what we could do, and now I'm going to go meditate. I'm going to rest. I'm going to center my attention, and I am going to set it down. You know, I'm going to give myself a break, right, for a moment before we pick it back up again. We'll come out in 4 days, and we'll see what the news is like. One of the core propositions of dependent origination is that to seeing dependent origination and seeing emptiness are the same thing. That things, that dependent origination works because phenomena are empty, right? If craving was a permanent thing, like if it wasn't empty, if it was a permanent, existent, you know, phenomena with a soul in a way, right, or an eternal essence, it wouldn't function in the flow of conditions. It wouldn't be conditioned by feeling, and it wouldn't itself condition clinging, which wouldn't itself condition becoming, which wouldn't itself condition, you know, birth. It's because nothing is actually fixed or static, in other words, it's because everything is empty of essence, that the condition process even works. And so without getting too philosophical on it, I think the thing that becomes practice for me again and again here is just to feel how in this moment, in the here and now, there's a state present. There's a state that I can feel. Some amount of energy, some amount of focus, some amount of feeling, you know. Different kinds of emotions are present. And different kinds of health or you know, dis-ease are present. And I can feel how these are both the impact of the past, right? My past actions, other people's past actions, past conditions have led to this, feeling this way. And we can feel how running through all of that, there's this, nothing is fixed, so everything is empty, but it's palpable. And running through all of it is this thread of agency, right? Part of what led to your state in this moment was your thoughts and actions, you know, 5 minutes ago, an hour ago, yesterday, last year, et cetera, all the way back. And, you know, your state in this moment is not, it's not completely conditioned by your own actions, right? Of course, it's subject to other people's. Other people have said things, done things that affect you, that have impact upon you. And again, all of the social things matter, right? The fact what country you're in, what your social location or positionality is in that country matters. You know, your race and class and gender matter. Whether you're in the mainstream or in the margins of a given, you know, community matter for your experience. But the Buddha looks again and again at, like, okay, a lot of that you can't control, like other people's words and actions. But the thing that you most clearly can is your own words and actions. And so that's what you can do to affect your own state in the future. So, you know, an hour from now, you're going to feel like something. Maybe you'll be asleep, maybe you'll be doing something else, but you'll have a certain state. What we are doing right now, right, sharing about our Halloween costumes, meditating together, thinking about dependent origination, thinking about the election, whatever you're doing in this moment, right? Doing the dishes, you know, in the background, whatever. This is part of what's contributing to your state an hour from now, right? This is going to have some repercussions. If I say something like super, you know, interesting, so occasionally happens, right? Maybe you're thinking about it an hour from now. If I stir you up about the election, maybe you're all verklempt and you're checking 538 an hour from now. Like, you know, what we do together is already changing how we feel, right? You already said, someone already said, like, oh, just hearing people, you know, share and say funny things about their Halloween costumes, like, it's uplifting. This is, you know, being conditioned, being responsive to conditions. And so this is really what our practice is we recognize that our actions, our words, and so all of the actions of practice, the discipline of sitting, the discipline of keeping the precept, the discipline of wise speech with each other, the practice just of getting together for something like this, different from any of the infinite other number of things you might be doing, if this is wholesome to you. This is a condition that, you know, gives rise to your future state. And so then our practice is to do things that, you know, give rise to more and more wholesome states in the future. So all of our practice is manifesting this limb of right effort, right? To cultivate wholesome states, to minimize unwholesome states. And so what dependent origination shows us is that this is how action and impact work. That we take actions, we say words, they have an impact on ourselves and others. And how we feel in any given moment is based on what we did and said in the past and what others did and said in the past. And we just have our part to play. And in any given moment, you have your words and actions to add to the mix for yourself, for others. You know, what you say in this room affects the others here. What you post on X affects somebody out there. How you cast your vote affects somebody out there and your own state of mind. And then when the sutra reminds us that these things are empty, part of what they're reminding us of is that they are so embedded in this play of conditions that it would be a mistake to, you know, in a way to fixate on them, to stick them or, you know, constrict around them, in a way to obsess about them as a distinct, specific thing. I think this happens sometimes in some, you know, some areas of like, you know, like self-help psychology, for instance. We could fixate on a certain trait that we have. I want to work on my, you know, avoidant attachment system. And it's helpful to do so, right? Like these kinds of concepts, you know, oh, I'm avoidantly attached, or I'm a yin metal pig in my Chinese astrology, you know, or both of which are true, you're occasionally useful, you know, or I'm an INTJ, you know, like sure. And whatever your categorical system is, I'm an Aquarius with a Pisces moon. Aquarius, you know, whatever, all of those things, psychological, you know, astrological, are concepts that are empty, right? They're just concepts. They're historically based. They are useful or not, depending on how we use them. But even when we use them and they're useful, they're still empty. And the experience that they're pointing to is empty. Right, it's a swirl of historically contingent concepts. It's changing all the time, and most to the point, it doesn't define me. Even if I can say like, yeah, I'm a yin metal pig because I was born in, you know, January of 1971, and at this moment, like, sure, I'll be a yin metal pig for the rest of this lifetime. Remember, the Buddha was like, yeah, this lifetime, it's just one of a gazillion. Right. In my next lifetime, I won't be a yin metal pig, you know, unless I die in my 59th year and I'm reborn in January of my 60th year, exactly at the return of yin metal pig in the 60-year cycle. Like, okay, absurd, not easy to do. It's not easy to have the same astrological sign two lifetimes in a row. You know, that's a great roll of the dice, right? But it would never happen over and over and over again. Those things don't define us, right? Our gender can't define us because you've been other kinds of bodies before, right? And your species can't define you. For the Buddha, yeah, you've been animals. You've been, you know, you've not only been other people's fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, you know, lover, enemy, everything in between, but you've also been other people's dinner and, you know, and the mosquito that gets slapped and everything, right? And so, you know, you can't separate the states and the experiences that are the content of conditionality. Those are empty. You can't separate those from the flow of impermanence and even from the flow of lifetimes. Because everything we think of as the most solid, you know, this is who I am. This is my story. This is my body. This is my culture. This is my political party. It's all contingent and changes, you know. You know, 150 years ago, the Republicans were the anti-slavery party and the Democrats were the pro-slavery party. And they flipped to be the other way around, right? Everything exists in the flux with everything else. And so dependent origination, the teachings on conditionality, teach us how each new moment's experience unfolds from the past. And then the teachings on karma, which are interwoven, they teach us how our actions are the motor of that unfolding, right? How our actions affect that unfolding. And so between those two, between the insight that everything is empty, conditioned, and deeply, fully embedded in the complex system of all of it. And then the teaching and then insight recognition that the only thing we have in this system where nothing is really ours because there's no one to be or have or own anything, that the thing that we have is our actions, which is to say we don't even have our actions. But they are what we do. We don't have them, but we do them. And they have impact. The main teaching is that they have impact. They create the conditions for our own future states, and the conditions for others' future states. So to end where we started with those two links of dependent origination, that there's feeling that is the condition for craving, Vedana is the condition for tanha. The possibility, the possible impact of our training, right? This is really the impact of the training in mindfulness, is that it's possible to be mindful of, which really means intimate with, present with, not at all in denial of, the force of affect. Some things are pleasant, some things are unpleasant, and that they can be felt fully and acted upon with wisdom without falling into the possible result of craving. It's actually possible to, with some focus and you know, letting go and all of the things that are the result of our training. I think this is one of the most beautiful results of practice, is the growing ability to be present with the uncomfortable, with things not being how I would like them to be, or how I think would be best, and to not suffer, to not be in anguish about. Right? That it's possible to be present with the uncomfortable, the not preferred, without suffering, and it's possible to be in the presence of the preferred and the comfortable, the delightful, without craving it, without needing more. I think it's really without needing more. Understanding that it will pass without needing to try to make it not pass. You could, you know, you can vote to preserve goodness, right? It's appropriate to set up the conditions for good things to maintain. But again, you can do that without falling into the constriction of the heart that says that I must hold on to this tightly. So, in a season where our actions, our words and our actions, at least in some way, impact, you know, the world through the democratic process, just see if you can find the places where you can both care deeply and not suffer about what's happening. So we'll let it go there for now. Blessings, vote, do all the things. Mm-hmm.